welcome to Zafshan Ratatzi and Yvonne Ridley, joining you from on board HMS President in the heart of the English capital.
And we're feeling very optimistic today, which is reflected in our theme, that hope springs eternal. The Arab Spring has certainly lifted expectations across the region, not least of all in Palestine.
And while a unity government is being formed between Fatah and Hamas, this Palestinian activist comes on board to exclusively reveal an international project targeting the Zionist state, which will force Israel to either put up or shut up when overseas visitors arrive to give solidarity to those living in occupied Palestine.
Meanwhile, thousands of miles away, an Egyptian cleric known as the Blind Sheikh, who has been held in a US prison for trying to overthrow Mubarak, may no longer be viewed as a public enemy. Will he be sprung thanks to the Arab Spring? This guest believes there's a chance.
And as Scots now look forward to determining their own future by voting on independence, the recent elections in the United Kingdom could deliver new hope for those not wanting to be ruled by Westminster. But the voters in Wales cut themselves adrift from their nationalist party, and this political journalist comes on board to explain why.
All of this and so much more, so stay tuned to the show which rocks the boat.
First guest has been hatching a plan to force the Zionist state's hand when it comes to dealing with overseas visitors.
He and literally hundreds of pro-Palestinian activists will be arriving in Ben Gurion Airport soon. But will they be allowed to travel to the West Bank and Jerusalem? Welcome to Mick Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Why reveal these details now?
Because we're fed up with flying into Ben-Gurion Airport on peaceful, legitimate business to go and visit Palestinian friends and being confronted at that airport by gatekeepers, by people who act as police and who in the past have turned back many a peaceful traveller who wishes to proceed to Bethlehem or Ramallah or Hebron. And we're just fed up, and our Palestinian hosts are asking us to come and visit them. And it's just perfectly natural to fly in there and to say, we have no wish to go to Israel, we wish to proceed to Bethlehem, and please let us through. And I have in my pocket a British passport where Her Britannic Majesty asks individuals and authorities to not to hinder people travelling and going about their legitimate business.
Everyone from the United Nations downwards knows how brutal Israeli forces can be. If there are hundreds and maybe thousands who do this at Tel Aviv Airport, what do you think the reaction from Israel will be?
Well, our aim is to go and visit some friends. The British government considers that the West Bank and Gaza are the embryo of a future Palestinian state. That's the official position. They consider this area to be illegally occupied. Therefore, we expect British consular protection when we arrive there. Other citizens from Germany, from France, Italy and Spain and so on, they will be expecting consular protection from their governments, and then we'll see what happens.
I can just hear ambassadors groaning now at the thought of yet another diplomatic spat with the Zionist state. What's to say that the Israelis won't just put you back on a plane and say, clear off, we don't want you?
Well, I think we will not want to turn around and go back. We wish to proceed to Bethlehem to meet with our hosts.
But we know how forceful the Israeli machine can be.
Well, we'll be pensioners, we'll be families, we'll be children, we'll be all sorts of people. If they wish to use force in Tel Aviv Airport, then so be it. Then we will resist as peaceful, you know, we'll resist peacefully. But I don't think that it's going to be logistically very easy to put, say, 500 or 700 people who resist peacefully and who struggle, peacefully, to take them up onto aircraft and fly them back to, you know, many, many destinations. Many pilots will refuse to accept someone on an aircraft who does not wish to go. So I think the Israelis will be faced with a choice, very clearly a choice, of allowing us to proceed to meet our friends and partners in Palestine or detaining us somewhere by the hundred. And if they detain us by the hundred, then we have no wish for this to happen, but at least it will flag up the fact that Israel is maintaining a very cruel siege of the West Bank, as not quite as ferocious. In fact, in some ways worse than the siege that that they maintained of Gaza. Because in the West Bank, let's not forget, there are gangs of soldiers who beat on doors, arrest and kidnap people every night. The walls ghettoise and render the lives of Palestinians there utterly miserable. It's completely illegal. The Goldstone report didn't just focus on Gaza. It also pointed out not just the long period of time, but that also in the West Bank, Israel was committing crimes against humanity.
Well, they've never been shy of detaining people in the past. How do you think your demonstration will change, will be changed by Fatah and Hamas having come together? Presumably they'll issue a statement if they start beating you up.
Well, look, that's a Palestinian business, Fatah and Hamas. They were elected in different proportions by the people of Palestine, and how they relate to each other is a Palestinian matter. It's not really our business.
But the European Union seems to take a dim view of them coming together, and of course it'll be those consulates that you'll be applying for help from.
Well, it's very peculiar that... I've just come down here from Scotland, and I think people in Scotland recently voted in a way that the London government was a little bit unhappy with. They didn't like the results. But when the Palestinians voted in a way that was unpleasing to the governments in London, they were mercilessly punished. We don't expect to be so punished up in Scotland. Look, what's happening to the Palestinians is grotesque. It's a series of crimes that Britain was there at the birth of and that Britain is now endorsing. So the British government will once again have a choice to support us in our peaceful endeavours to go to the West Bank and meet with our friends, to give us consular protection, to honour the words inside the front cover of the British passport, or to once again support the Israelis. Now, I recall that when Scottish people and British people were kidnapped off ships in open waters, we could not persuade the previous foreign minister, Miliband, to use the word piracy or to use the word kidnap. They have a choice, and we'll give them a choice.
Challenging
yes or no.
Times ahead, Mick, and especially with the Freedom Flotilla set to sail around the same time.
Absolutely.
We'll be following
initiatives.
Details on your website, and of course, any Israelis welcome, aren't they?
If your viewers French is okay, they can access the website, Bienvenue Palestine. The initiative came from France, and people around the world are supporting it.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we've just had local elections in the United Kingdom, as well as a referendum on democracy itself. As for the referendum, there's going to be no change to the way Britain's elect governments. Most people didn't even bother to vote.
Meanwhile, Scottish voters can look forward to deciding whether or not to vote for their independence. The recent election results in Wales told a different story.
Welcome, Martin Shipton. You're an expert on the Welsh Parliament. Why did, for instance, the Nationalists do so badly?
I think one of the problems has been that for the last 4 years they have been in coalition with Labour, and during the course of this election campaign they tried to blame Labour for everything that was wrong with Wales, and of course that didn't really go down very well because they've been in partnership with Labour for the last 4 years, so their message didn't really resonate.
It's not a missed opportunity though, Martin, by the Welsh people. I mean, we've seen what's happening over in the Scottish border. It could spell the end of the United Kingdom as we know it.
Scottish nationalism is a lot stronger than Welsh nationalism for many historical reasons, and Wales isn't as far down the route as Scotland is. We recently had a referendum a couple of months ago, and people did vote for more powers for the National Assembly, and from next week, when the Assembly will be resuming its activities, Wales for the first time will be able to make its own laws. But still, unlike Scotland, many people are very much tied into the UK scenario. One thing, for example, to mention is that whereas in Scotland 80% of the people buy newspapers that are produced in Scotland, in Wales 80% of the people buy newspapers that are produced in England, and therefore the sense of national identity is not as strong in Wales for the majority of people as Scottish identity is for people living in Scotland.
People in Wales suffer disproportionately because of the economic crisis at the moment. They have suffered during the Labour government as well. Child poverty, regional variations. Surely they blame the Conservatives and Labour.
Well, what they tend to do in Wales is whenever there is a Conservative government, or in this case a Conservative-led government, the default position for people in Wales is to vote Labour. And the Nationalist Party, Plaid Cymru, is not able to capitalise on the situation in the way that the SNP in Scotland is, because many people in Wales who are not Welsh speakers still see the Welsh Nationalist Party as a party whose predominant interest is serving the interests of those who are Welsh speakers. And that is a big problem for Welsh nationalists, whereas, of course, in Scotland, the language issue does not play at all.
Your book, Poor Man's Parliament, why the title?
Well, it's called Poor Man's Parliament because when the Assembly was set up in 1999, it didn't have anywhere near the same powers as the Scottish Parliament did. And Wales, as is very often the case, was perceived as something of an afterthought in the devolution process. The Assembly that Wales was offered in 1999 was an uneasy compromise between those people, for the benefit of those people who were against any kind of institution for Wales and those who wanted things to move forward. And that's been the story of devolution up until now, really.
The British government wants to cut government spending. Wales depends on government spending. How is that going to change political allegiances? Because Labour and Conservative manifestos aren't particularly that different when it comes to cuts because of the present economic crisis.
Well, this is a problem because Wales has got very severe economic problems that are going to take more than an electoral cycle to sort out. It hasn't recovered from the closure of all the coal mines in Wales, which occurred over a period of decades, and the last one closed a couple of years ago. Also, there are far fewer people working in steelworks than used to be the case. So Wales really needs some magic manoeuvre in order to escape from this economic position. But it's the poorest country in the UK, and there are no signs in the immediate future of things improving.
Well, Martin, thank you for coming on board with your excellent analysis. Thank you.
Thank you, Hon.
Were supported and backed by the Americans. And one of the things that they kept Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman for this long time is because of the dictator Hosni Mubarak.
The Arab Spring is still very much ongoing in the region, but it could have positive repercussions for the plight of Omar Abdulrahman, also known as the Blind Sheikh.
Just a few days ago, several hundred gathered outside the US Embassy to demand his release and were joined today by Masood Shajara from the Islamic Human Rights Commission to explain why there is renewed hope for this iconic sheikh. It's down to the Arab Spring, isn't it, Masood?
Yes, it is. I mean, the reality is that the sheikh was originally arrested and prosecuted because of pressures by Hosni Mubarak. And one of the things that was prosecuted was the fact that he was trying to overthrow Hosni Mubarak, which he never denied. By that definition, all Egyptians, or overwhelming majority of Egyptians now, should be in prison because they all want to overthrow and indeed overthrow Mubarak. So that is actually one change. And the other very significant change is that, you know, when I was in Egypt and we had a long discussion with the son of Sheikh and indeed his supporters, because of the pressure is being put, both the government in Egypt and indeed the head of Al-Azhar now have officially asked United States for him to be transferred into Egypt. And that is very significant because...
There has been huge concern as well over his treatment inside the US prison system in terms of receiving phone calls, being allowed visitors. Can you elaborate on that?
He was being sort of internally, a strip search and internally examined every time he went to see his even solicitor.
He might have been quite heroic in his struggle against Mubarak, but he did advocate the killing of US people, destruction of US companies, transportation links. I know he never committed a crime because the court itself said he was planning something.
All the solicitors I've spoken to, they say that if that particular law was not used, which hasn't been used for 100 years, he wouldn't have been found guilty and put in prison.
This was the law of sedition, wasn't
it? Sedition,
yes.
And that law, indeed, if he used it in that way, he could put anyone in prison. And I actually think that, you know, the Sheikh case highlights the sort of war on terror before 9/11. You know, the, all these things that's been sort of talked about.
What about his lawyer, of course, Lynn Stewart, who's also been put into jail? Any hope for her?
No, I actually think that there has to be more activity in campaigning for her. When I was in the States 2 weeks ago, I spoke to a number of lawyers, and now we are trying to actually organize a whole lot of celebrities to actually go and visit her, or try to attempt to go and visit her and make some news. Because the fact of the matter is, not only Sheikh was being abused, now his lawyers are actually being put in prison. And this is outrageous. I mean, Lynn Stewart is a formidable lawyer. She has served liberty both in the United States and elsewhere for many, many years. She's got cancer, and to be put in prison on accusation that she's passed information or was involved in the passing sort of terrorist information.
Of course, the irony now is that Mubarak is himself being investigated and could end up in prison as well.
Yeah, we hope that many others, sort of ex-tyrants, both in not just in the Muslim world, but in elsewhere, will one day see them in court, including Tony Blair and Bush.
Well, I don't think the Americans want to hear Hosni Mubarak's evidence, though, do you? Because it'll show rather close involvement.
Yes, yeah, this close relationship, which has been an instrument of oppressing Egyptians. It's been very apparent and very clear to all the Egyptians, and I think people in the West have just hide their head in the sand like ostriches. And the reality is that you cannot oppress overwhelming majority of people because you see your interest in serving, you know, putting in a
tyrant. Thank you very much for coming on board.
Thank you, Masoud. And the Arab Spring is also proving a challenge for the financial and oil experts who monitor and react to daily events unfolding in the region.
We were recently joined by Chatham House expert analyst Paul Stevens, and this is what he told us.
Professor Paul Stevens, you're an expert on the oil and the money markets. You've just returned from the Middle East. How has the Arab People's Revolution affected both of these issues?
I think there's been a couple of major impacts. The first has been actually on physical supply. The events in Libya, for example, have taken about 1.5 million barrels a day off the market. On the other hand, that was a market that was already comfortably supplied, so that's not such a big deal. The other impact has been on perception amongst the money managers who operate in the paper markets, the futures markets, NYMEX in New York, the ICE here in London. And unfortunately, a lot of these individuals think the Middle East is all the same. So they take the view that what happened yesterday in Tunisia and Egypt will happen tomorrow in Saudi Arabia and the other major exporters of the Gulf Cooperation Council countries. In my view, that's extremely unlikely. The situation in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Abu Dhabi and Qatar, which together account for about 12 million barrels a day of exports, is very different from the situation we saw in North Africa, or indeed that we're seeing at the moment in Syria. The fact that King Abdullah has spent $37 billion 7 or 8 weeks ago, and then a few weeks ago another $93 billion, will buy a great deal of support amongst the population.
So well, what is the impact on the Saudis of that kind of, well, some people are saying unkindly perhaps, that the Saudis are buying off their population to
well,
stop further
the implication for the oil market longer term is extremely important. I mentioned the $37 billion that he'd given away. That's equivalent to $10 on the price of a barrel of oil. Now, the implication of that is that 6 months ago the Saudis were saying that they were content with $70 to $80 a barrel. Well, it means that they're now content with $80 to $90 a barrel. And if you then add the $93 billion, you're up to a requirement of over $100 a barrel. So the surviving governments in the region to survive are going to have to spend a lot of money.
That sounds very serious, because revolutionary fervor then affecting business plans of China. China, and of course the United States.
Yeah, it depends upon your view as to how far the global economy can survive with prices over $100 a barrel. And there are serious question marks about that. The question is, you know, if we were heading towards a double dip recession, then very much higher oil prices are going to push us in that direction fairly quickly.
How is this going to affect the person at the petrol pump who's putting gas or fuel into their car now?
Well, in a European context, not a great deal. And the reason I say this is because only about 20% of the price of gasoline in Western Europe is accounted for by the price of crude oil. The rest of it, the majority of it, comes from the sales taxes imposed by the consumer governments.
And for our viewers in America?
There's more likely to be an impact because there's much less of a cushion in terms of sales tax between the price of crude oil. And already we're seeing the price of gasoline in the US rising considerably. And it is having an effect on demand.
Big oil majors were in talks, certainly with governments, ahead of the Iraq invasion. Tell us a bit, it may be too simplistic to say it's just about oil, but what is the context of policy planners in governments about interventions such
as
Libya?
Yeah, I mean, I take the view on Iraq that Iraq had very little to do with oil. If the Americans wanted to get access to Iraqi oil, there were a lot cheaper ways of doing it than going to war.
But we knew that BP and Shell and Exxon were in talks before.
They're in talks with governments all the time, and governments are always in talks with the oil companies. But again, going back to the Iraq invasion of 2003, if you make a list of reasons why the US wanted to invade Iraq, you've got a long list of reasons ranging from the neocons' political agenda to the sort of conflict between the Bush clan and the Al-Tikrit and all of this sort of thing. So oil comes way down the list.
Well, Professor Paul Stevens, thank you very much for your excellent analysis.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Pakistan is still reeling from the news that it was home to Osama bin Laden during the war on terrorism, according to US intelligence.
Our next guest comes on board to assess the long and short term consequences for the country. He's just written a book called, rather appropriately, Pakistan, a Hard Country. Welcome, Professor Anatol Levin. First of all, what was your immediate reaction when you heard the news?
Well, my immediate reaction was that probably somebody in Pakistani intelligence did know he was there, simply because they should have checked that house for possible attacks on the Pakistani army.
But how incompetent are US agencies then at monitoring ISI?
Well, it's not a matter of incompetence, it's a matter of lack of trust on both sides, of course, and lack of coordination. My second thought, which is obvious, is this is going to be very bad for Pakistani-US relations. It hasn't actually been as bad as I thought, because clearly there is a desire on both sides, you know, to keep things more or less on
track. But there is speculation now, and in fact, Lord Nazir Ahmed was here just last week saying Pakistan should tell America to get lost and start embracing and welcoming in China.
Well, yes, that is certainly a possibility, if the Chinese actually want that. I mean, they've been making some positive signs over the past 10 days. But equally, will the Chinese really invest very heavily in Pakistan's economy? That's not clear yet. There isn't a great deal of confidence among the Chinese in the Pakistani economy as yet. So I think this is a possibility for Pakistan, but it's not a certainty. As yet.
Overhead helicopters again. Every time we mention Pakistan these days, yeah. I'm sure it's purely coincidence.
Your book says the army is the strongest institution in the country.
Yes, so that's not, of course, saying very much, as I always point out. But yes, it is, simply because the others are so weak, and it will go on being so. Although the army has, of course, taken a knock from what's just happened, both from, you know, the suspicions that they knew about bin Laden, but also, of course, by an American raid on Pakistani territory.
What of the future of Pakistan? Because the government does appear to be servile and subservient to the US. Can you see another military coup happening there?
I don't think the military wants to seize power for the moment. I mean, they may well do at some stage in future if the entire political system falls to pieces again. But frankly, just at the moment, the military would rather have a civilian government that can catch some of the flak from what's going on. Because don't shouldn't forget, I mean, it's also the military that's been cooperating with the Americans in many ways. No, I think most probably this government will be allowed to trundle on to the next elections and will then fall and be replaced by a government led by the opposition. The question then will become, would a PMLN-led government try to create some kind of break with the Americans, or would it actually be forced?
Interesting times ahead, Professor. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today's guests, go on to our website www.ritansi-ridley.com, and don't forget we're also on Twitter and Facebook.
See you all at the same time, same place next week.